Very honored to be in this pulpit. I have ridden my bike past here many times and wondered about what was in this turf, and now I know. I want to talk about Abraham and Sarah and Hagar and draw some contrasts. If you've been a person who reads Genesis very often, getting past the creation stories, there's a famous story about Abraham and Sarah in chapter 18 of Genesis. And it gives us a very different picture of Abraham and Sarah than the picture that we get of both of them today. Instead of a story in which they cast someone out, they invite people in. Instead of a story in which they worry about a rivalry, they welcome people in to share a fine meal. And instead of a story in which they practice scarcity, they think there's not enough for everybody, they practice hospitality in which there is more than enough for everybody. Now you might remember that story in Genesis 18. There were three strangers who arrived at the tent of Abraham in the heat of the day. And we're in on the secret of that story. Those strangers are actually angels, messengers from God. Abraham welcomes them, and he and Sarah serve them a wonderful meal. And in return, they promise Abraham and Sarah that despite their being quite old, they will conceive and give birth to a child. Sarah, in the background, laughs. But the angels, of course, had the last laugh. Sarah, in fact, gets pregnant, and Isaac is the child of that pregnancy. This story is also referred to in the New Testament, in Hebrews chapter 13, verses 1 to 3. Do not neglect to offer hospitality to strangers, for in doing so, some have welcomed angels. When I'm not at Memphis Theological Seminary trying to be a professor and soon to be the academic dean, I keep myself grounded in the reality of human life at a place called Manor House. Manor House is a place of hospitality for people in poverty, many of whom are also homeless. And when I serve there, I often wonder, because I'm traversing world between seminary and Manor House and Germantown and Midtown and Manor House, I often wonder how it is that in a society that has so much wealth, we also have so much poverty. And I don't ask that question as an economist or a politician, and you should be thankful for that. But I do try to ask it as a person of faith, even as a theologian and even as a Christian ethicist. Now, that doesn't mean I ignore economics and politics, but it does mean that I ask, what do poverty and homelessness in our society reveal about us as human beings? What do poverty and homelessness in our society reveal about our very relationship not only with each other, but with God? And I also try to ask those questions in the light of the gospel of Jesus Christ. We had two Old Testament readings this morning. We might be wondering, where's the gospel today? And how is that gospel going to enlighten all of the life-shaping stories that we have in the Bible, including this kind of confusing story from Genesis this morning, in which Abraham and Sarah throw out their slave and Abraham's own child to die in the desert? What are we to make of that? So I'm going to ask, how did Abraham and Sarah, and how do we get into such a mindset of scarcity that we cast out our own flesh? How did Abraham and Sarah and we lose our commitment to hospitality when we know that when we offer hospitality, we welcome the very messengers of God, angels? I think the story we heard today gives a simple but profound answer to that question. We get into a mindset of scarcity and lose our commitment to hospitality when we give into something I know I give into, rivalry. And we start believing in scarcity rather than trusting in God's abundance. This is exactly what happened to Sarah. Listen, but Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had born to Abraham, playing with her son Isaac. She said to Abraham, "Cast out this slave woman with her son, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac." And we need to remember a few things about Sarah and her situation, which also we get from reading earlier into Genesis. Sarah knew barrenness. She knew scarcity in a very intense way. As the wife of Abraham, a wealthy and well-respected man, she certainly shared in his wealth and in his honor. But as a barren woman, she also shared in all the dishonor and disrespect that barrenness brought to her in her society. And if you read Genesis, you'll find out that she blamed God for her barrenness. Even in the midst of all that abundance that she shared with Abraham, she blamed God for scarcity, a scarcity that she felt very deeply. Now, we also need to pay attention to Hagar. Though young and capable of bearing children, she was a slave. She was under the domination of Sarah and Abraham. Abraham and Sarah were slave owners, and Hagar was one of their slaves. And slavery, by its very nature, is degrading and dehumanizing, and thrives by continuing scarcity in the lives of the slaves. Earlier in Genesis, Sarah, as slave master over Hagar, had ordered Hagar to have sex with Abraham. It's good we had the children go out, really start to hear this story, so that Sarah could have a child via Hagar. Hagar is not consulted in this manner. She is commanded. She's a slave. And we need to remember that the child born to Hagar would have legally belonged to Sarah. What Sarah thought God was preventing, namely her pregnancy, she would obtain through Hagar. Sarah hoped that her status would be raised by getting this child through Hagar. Genesis 16:2, "Perhaps I will be esteemed through her." But Sarah's plan to escape her perceived scarcity didn't work out so well. First, when Hagar becomes pregnant, Sarah becomes jealous of Hagar. So she complains to Abraham that Hagar the slave is getting uppity. Abraham, in response, makes sure that Hagar is reduced again to the role of a slave. He gives Sarah full authority over Hagar. And Sarah begins to treat Hagar harshly. And that's when Hagar runs away for the first time, when she leaves for the first time. She sought to escape, but she gets out in the desert and she doesn't know where to go. And God intervenes, and an angel tells Hagar to go back. So Hagar returns and raises her child, Ishmael. Meanwhile, see how complicated the Bible can be? Meanwhile, thanks to God's mercy following Abraham and Sarah's hospitality to strangers, Sarah miraculously gets pregnant and gives birth to Isaac. And this is where our story picks up. After the birth of Isaac, Sarah's rivalry with Hagar is renewed. And that rivalry, as renewed, gives Sarah a renewed sense of scarcity. Even though she now has the abundance of having her own child, Sarah sees Hagar, the child of Hagar, Ishmael, and her child, Isaac, playing together. like equals. And that's when she says to Abraham, cast this slave woman out, for the son of this slave woman shall not inherit along with my son Isaac. There's not enough for both of them. And Abraham complies. The story says he kind of worries about it, but in the end, he's willing to cast Hagar and Ishmael out. Maybe to avoid responsibility for either one of them. Maybe he thought the whole situation was just getting too complex and he wanted to wash his hands of the whole matter. We don't really know the inner workings of Abraham, but we do know his action. He sends Hagar and his own son, Ishmael, into the wilderness with rather meager provisions, a backpack of food and one skin of water. Sarah and Abraham, it seems, both thought first about their own security. Even though God had shown both of them mercy in giving them Isaac, neither of them was willing to show mercy to a woman whose back was up against the wall. Where is their mercy in this story? Where is their redemption? Well, God hears the voice of the boy and also responds to the voice of Hagar. God, as the psalmist says, hears the cry of the poor. Turn to me and be gracious to me. Give your strength to your servant. Save the child of your serving girl. Psalm 86:18. God points Hagar to water, to life, to abundance. Now liberated from Abraham and Sarah and welcomed by God, Hagar finds her own life, and she is able to also provide for her son. So the story ends with Hagar finding a wife for her son. His mother got a wife for him from the land of Egypt, and they lived happily ever after. All right, that's the story of redemption. Now, what's this got to do with us? It's kind of the strange stories of slaves and being impregnated by their masters, and Abraham throwing them both out. It's just kind of weird. What do these biblical stories have to say, perhaps, to the questions I asked earlier? How is it in our society that has so much wealth that we also have so much poverty? What do poverty and homelessness reveal about our relationship with God and our relationship with each other? Well, one of the things we might say based in this story is that we have poverty in the midst of wealth because poverty pays. Abraham and Sarah both benefited from slavery, just like all slave owners profit and gain wealth from slavery. If I don't pay you for your work, but do get paid for what your labor produces, then I make a pretty good profit. Think if you own a business, if you wouldn't have to pay wages, how much more profit you could make. That's wonderful if you're the one making profit. This is ground this in our own history in this country. In 1860s, slaves in this country, as an asset, were worth more than all of America's manufacturing, all of the railroads, and all of the productive capacity of the United States put together. That's a lot of wealth. Slaves were the single largest, by far, financial asset of property in the entire U.S. economy. No wonder people didn't want to give up their slaves. It was giving up a tremendous amount of wealth. You can even go downtown to downtown Memphis, and there's a historical marker just behind Calvary Episcopal Church. And it's a historical marker about Nathan Bedford Forrest. Says that his home was located there. And then it says that he was a successful businessman, and it says he was even a millionaire. It does not mention what his business was, which was selling slaves. His slave market was about two blocks west on that same street. Now today, slavery's gone, right, in the United States. It's illegal. Today in the United States, what's this got to do with us? How do people in poverty today generate wealth like slaves did in the past? But when people are in poverty, they get desperate. They'll work for lower wages, and they'll do dirty and dangerous jobs. We have guests at Manna House, many of whom are now in their 50s and 60s, who did these dirty and dangerous jobs for years, never got paid very much, then got hurt on the job, and they end up homeless. There are also people who are desperate are more susceptible to scams, like the big scam of the state lottery that says you can get rich quick by buying a lottery ticket. Most people who are upper middle class or middle class, we don't buy that. We know that you don't get rich quick buying the lottery. The odds are against it. So why throw our money away? We'll invest it, which is a much better way to make money. Meanwhile, wealthy persons also make money off of programs that are designed to help people out of poverty. I'm just going to read you a quote from the newspaper. I just came across this as preparing for this sermon. Karl Barth said you should always read the Bible with the Bible in one hand and a newspaper in the other hand. So this was, I'm quoting, President Trump's budget calls for sharply reducing funding for programs that shelter the poor and combat homelessness, with a notable exception. It leaves intact a type of federal housing subsidy that is paid directly to private landlords. And one of those landlords is Trump himself, who earns millions of dollars each year as a part owner of Starrett City, the nation's largest subsidized housing complex. He has only a 4% stake in this, by the way, and yet it earned him at least $5 million between January of last year and this April 15th. According to a recent financial disclosure. That's how people like you and me can make money off of people who are in poverty. I could go on, but I think you get my point. That slavery is gone, and yet we can still benefit from the scarcity of other people. Now, this leads to a second point. We come to fear the poor because we believe in scarcity more than we believe in God's abundance. One of the first principles I learned in a macroeconomics class was the principle of scarcity. The worldview of scarcity is this principle. Every resource is to some degree scarce. That's what we're taught in economics classes. That is, there's never enough of anything. And now this is our economics. It's premised upon scarcity. And that always leaves us afraid, a little insecure, about not having enough. And that, of course, is the basis for rivalry. We start to compare ourselves with other people. Sarah feared, going back to the Bible now, Sarah feared not having enough, even though she was married to a wealthy man and shared in his wealth. First of all, she feared that her own barrenness left her in a vulnerable position. And thus, because she focused on her scarcity in the midst of her abundance, even a slave could become a rival to her. Our tendency as human beings is to focus on the scarcity in our lives rather than on our abundance. And when we focus on scarcity, on what we don't have, we start to get into rivalry, and we start to seek to dominate and to exploit others. We forget a very, very basic teaching that's also in the book of Genesis. Go back to the first two chapters, that we are all God's children, that we're all in this together. And I think this is why Jesus preaches such a gospel of abundance. He wants to remind us of who we are, and how fullness of life comes when we share life with each other. Jesus preached this gospel of abundance in many ways. We would have had the gospel reading for today's lectionary. We would have heard this. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father. And even the hairs of your head, I don't have too many to count anymore, but they are all counted. So do not be afraid. You are of more value than many sparrows. Now, Jesus did more than just preach a gospel of abundance. He also practiced a gospel of abundance. We might recall that on one occasion, he fed 4,000 people, and on another occasion, 5,000 people, from just a few loaves and fishes. His disciples were in that mindset of scarcity. Well, we've got a few loaves and fishes, but Lord, Jesus, that's not going to be enough. And Jesus says, sit the people down. We're going to pray. We're going to give thanks for what we have. And then we're going to start to share. And lo and behold, there is more than enough for everybody. And we might recall that Jesus healed for free. We might even recall that at the wedding at Cana, he made wine out of water, and there was more than enough. The gospel of abundance recognizes a very basic principle of biblical economics, that we will have enough, more than enough, if we do something very simple but very difficult, which is something we learned as children, to share. Scarcity tries to tell us to never share because there's never enough for everybody. We're afraid of people. Poverty continues because we don't trust in God's abundance, and then we become convinced that we don't have enough to share. Abraham and Sarah put Hagar out because they did not trust God's abundance. They were convinced that they had neither the material nor the emotional resources to share in the raising of Ishmael with Hagar. And so this is finally what poverty and wealth reveal about our relationship with God. Either we trust in God's abundance and thus share generously, or we cower in fear of scarcity and thus regard others as rivals in the competition for scarce resources. And we should know that great wealth can never eliminate that spirit of scarcity. We might jump ahead to Christmas for just a minute and remember the contrast between Scrooge, who never thought he had enough, and Bob Cratchit, who had very little but celebrated with abundance. Now, it's important to remember, and this is grounded again in the story of Abraham and Sarah, that God is not opposed to wealth in and of itself. Abraham and Sarah are wealthy, and Jesus, too, never condemns wealth in and of itself. For God, the question is not wealth. The question is, what do we do with our wealth? And also, how did we gain our wealth? Wealth is to be shared. That's what we're called to do, in a spirit of generosity. And that's how the story ends today, with redemption and with abundance. God brings Hagar to water and to life. In God's creation, there is water, and it's there in abundance. And it's God's will that we have abundant, life-giving water. Hagar thought, because she got into scarcity too, she thought there wasn't any water, and that she and her son were going to die from that scarcity. But God showed her the water. If you might be old enough, you might see a movie reference there. Show me the money? No. Show me the water. I was just making sure you're still paying attention. And that's the gospel. That's the gospel, the good news of redemption that we need to especially take with us. We don't want to walk out of here with a sense of, oh my God, too much scarcity. We want to walk out of here with the thankfulness of the abundance that's in our lives, thanking God for the abundance that we already share, thanking God for the abundance that was shared, for example, in building this building, and that keeps a school going. Those things aren't for free, right? We need to share in order to keep our communities going. We will flourish if we share together, not only with each other, but even with all of God's creatures. There's no need for us to be like Abraham and Sarah in this story and throw the slave Hagar and her son Ishmael out into the desert. There's no need for us as people of faith to cast away those in poverty, fearing that there's not enough, fearing that they are rivals to us in an economy of scarcity. Rather, God calls us to the living water, to the way of Jesus. And in the way of Jesus, there is abundant life. Jesus himself even tells us in John chapter 10, verse 10, "I have come that they may have life and have it abundantly." Jesus gives us a way in which we can flourish together. He gives us a way of welcome. He gives us a way of hospitality. He gives us a way of sharing. He gives us a way that is grounded in God's graciousness, a way that calls us to trust in God's abundance. Jesus pushes away that fear of scarcity. His way takes away the rivalry and the division between us that scarcity causes. In Jesus' way, we come to the living water in which we are in this life together. We come to the living water in which we are all God's children, no matter how we came into this world. And we come to the living water in a faith that God has made the world in such a way that each of us will live well when we share God's abundance.